There is no empathy in heaven. I guarantee you, I'll tell you before you get there. There isn't any empathy in heaven because there's no mortality. There's no empathy in utopia because there is no suffering. Empathy is grounded in the acknowledgement of death and the celebration of life and rooting for each other to flourish and be. It's based on our frailties and our imperfections. So when we talk about building an empathic civilization, we're not talking about utopia. We're talking about the ability of human beings to show solidarity, not only with each other, but our fellow creatures who have a one and only life on this little planet. We are homo empathicus. So here's the question. We know that consciousness changes in history. The way our brain is wired today is not the way a medieval serf's brain would be wired, and their brain wouldn't be the same as the wiring of a forager hunter 30,000 years ago. So the question I asked at the beginning of this study 6 years ago is, how does consciousness change in history? Because I wanted to imagine the following proposition. Is it possible that we human beings who are soft-wired for empathic distress, is it possible we could actually extend our empathy to the entire human race as an extended family and to our fellow creatures as part of our evolutionary family and to the biosphere as our common community? If it's possible to imagine that, then we may be able to save our species and save our planet. And what I say to you tonight, if it's impossible to even imagine that, I don't see how we're going to make it. Empathy is the invisible hand. Empathy is what allows us to stretch our sensibility with another so that we can cohere in larger social units. To empathize is to civilize. To civilize is to empathize. With forager hunter societies, communication only extended to the local tribe and shouting distance. Everyone over in the next mountain was the alien other. So empathy only extended to blood ties. When we went to the great hydraulic agricultural civilization, script allowed us to extend the central nervous system and to annihilate more time and space and bring more people together. And the differentiation of skills and the increasing selfhood not only led to theological consciousness, but empathy now extended to a new fiction. And that is, instead of just associating with one's blood ties, we detribalized and began association based on religious ties. So a new fiction, Jews start to see all other Jews as extended family and empathize with Jews. Christians start to see all other Christians as extended family and empathize with Christians. Muslims, the same. When we get to the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution, and we extend markets now to larger areas and create a fiction called the nation state. And all of a sudden, the Brits start to see others in Britain as extended family. The Germans start to see Germans as extended family, the Americans as Americans. There was no such thing as Germany. There was no such thing as France. These are fictions. But they allow us to extend our family so that we can have loyalties and identities based on the new complex energy communication revolutions we have that annihilate time and space. But if we have gone from empathy in blood ties to empathy in religious associational ties, to empathy based on national identification, is it really a big stretch to imagine the new technologies allowing us to connect our empathy to the human race writ large in a single biosphere? And what reason would we stop here at the nation-state identity and only have ideological empathy or theological-based empathy or tribal-based blood-tie empathy? We have the technology that allows us to extend the central nervous system and to think viscerally as a family, not just intellectually. When that earthquake hit Haiti and then Chile, but especially Haiti, within an hour the Twitters came out, and within 2 hours some cell phone videos, YouTube, and within 3 hours the entire human race was in an empathic embrace coming to the aid of Haiti. If we were, as the Enlightenment philosopher suggested, in materialistic, self-interested, utilitarian, pleasure-seeking, it couldn't account for the response to Haiti. Apparently, 175,000 years ago in the Rift Valley of Africa, there were about 10,000 anatomically modern human beings walking the grasslands, our ancestors. The geneticists located one database woman. It's a database line. Apparently, her genes passed to everyone in this room tonight. The other ladies didn't make it. Gets even more strange. They located a single male. This is a database line for genetics. They call him the Y chromosome Adam. Apparently, a fairly potent guy. His genes passed to everyone in this room. So here's the news. 6.8 billion people at various stages of consciousness, theological, ideological, psychological, dramaturgical, we're all fighting with each other with different ideas about the world, and guess what? We all came from two people. The Bible got this one right. We could have come from many, but the point is we have to begin thinking as an extended family. We have to broaden our sense of identity. We don't lose the old identities of nationhood and our religious identities and even our blood ties. But we extend our identity so we can think of the human race as our fellow sojourners and our other creatures here as part of our evolutionary family and the biosphere as our community.
I think Rifkin's emphasis on re-envisioning our social institutions is a very important one. And our last presentation on the show about the subject of rankism, a word coined by the speaker, Robert Fuller, will show us that it might just be a matter of the heart. It might not require a great deal of time or effort as much as a raising of consciousness. And he suggests this would take 4 or 5 generations, considering the common threat which faces humanity in terms of all manner of ecological crises, which are well known to listeners of the show. I think it's not perhaps too optimistic to think that in our lifetimes we will see a huge turnaround of perspectives. Robert Fuller is coming from, in some ways, a very traditional perspective. That is, he's a firm believer in the importance of the market and the democracy, and so certain issues such as widespread voting fraud have obviously passed him by. I find it encouraging that even from inside the world of the corporate media consensus, he has reached the conclusions that he has. And as more and more people seek alternative information using channels such as the internet, I'm very optimistic about the prospects of fundamental revolution in consciousness happening in a very short space of time. Now here's an interview with Robert Fuller about rankism and dignity for all.
Robert Fuller was, by his own description, a nobody when he sent me an unpublished book on what he called rankism, the abuse of power associated with rank, as in pulling rank on someone or ranking someone out. Even though he had been a past president of Oberlin College, he was at that time an unpublished author who, in his view of rankism, saw much of our society and its institutions divided into somebodies and nobodies. We had him on forum to talk about his ideas, and not long after that, his first book, Somebodies and Nobodies, was published. It received a good deal of attention and vaunted him by his own description back into being a somebody. Now he has taken these ideas of somebodies and nobodies and abuses of power with rank and published a book about dignity in politics and what he describes as a dignitarian society. The book is called All Rise, Somebodies, Nobodies, and the Politics of Dignity. Robert Fuller has a PhD from Princeton, taught at Columbia, and served as chair of the global nonprofit Internews, in addition to serving as president of Oberlin, which was his alma mater, and he joins us for the second hour forum. And good to have you back. And this is kind of a success story, really, isn't it?
Well, maybe. And if so, Forum is the place where it all began. I was here 6 years ago, as you say, with an unpublished manuscript that no one would touch. But Forum was willing to give me a chance to explain the ideas in it, and that opened a lot of doors. I mean, there are forums in every city of the United States. They call themselves different things. But one way or another, they're a marketplace for ideas. But most of them are only a marketplace for old ideas. And I like to think that San Francisco's forum, KQED's forum, is a marketplace for some new ideas as well. So
nice,
thank you, Michael.
Thank you for that. This has taken off, though. I mean, in terms of, it's almost become grassroots. The idea of dignitarian politics and the idea of how rank plays into that seems to really have reached a lot of people and is reaching even more people as we speak.
I think so. I've been on a couple hundred shows since Somebody's Nobody's came out, and I do feel a grassroots dignity movement emerging, but it's still in the consciousness-raising stage. It's not in the stage of people marching in the streets. And in fact, it may never go that direction. It may never look like a million man march. It may be more a million organizations that take a close look at themselves, how rank figures in those hierarchies, where it's valid and where it isn't, and where rank is legitimate and where it's nothing but rankism, and prune that out of their organizations to make them more productive.
Lest anybody get any confusion about this, you're not talking about eliminating rank. I mean, you're quite mindful of the fact that rank is a necessary part of our society. What you're talking about is abuses of rank and where rank is used against other people in dehumanizing and objectifying ways and so forth.
That is exactly the key distinction that lies at the foundation of the whole of dignitarian politics. Rank, we get used to really as children. Our parents outrank us. And then we go to work, and our boss outranks us. And we go to school, and our teacher, professors, they outrank us. And they, in turn, are outranked by deans and presidents in some institutions. But and the truth is, we love people who hold high rank, so long as they've earned it and exercise it with respect for the dignity of their subordinates. But when they abuse their rank, when they self-aggrandize, when they humiliate subordinates, we feel that indignity. We're acutely sensitive to it, actually, and it festers and turns into indignation. And then it can burst out and cause great damage, as at Columbine and as in various wars and problems we see all through politics. So I've tried to make the distinction between rank, which is your place in the hierarchy, and rankism, which is abusing a place you have in the hierarchy invariably towards someone lower down in that hierarchy.
And you're defining dignity really in a kind of negative way, that is indignity. Or
I really am. I mean, if you try to find liberty, it's not easy. But we all know when our liberty has been curtailed. And similarly with dignity, it's hard to define, although I could take a stab at it, but we really are tuned to detect the faintest hint of indignity because it's often a prelude to subordination and even banishment. And if you go back a few 10,000 years, that kind of banishment from the tribe was tantamount to death. And now it's tantamount to some kind of exploitation, whether it's in high school where a clique will indignifies some other student, or whether it's in the military or in a hospital, it's always setting someone up for exploitation. And that's why we're so sensitive to indignity. And the dignitarian movement is a movement that says dignity for all. Every human being deserves equal dignity. They are not of equal rank, but no matter what their rank, they should be treated with equal dignity. And that broad concept can be translated into has a lot of political implications.
Well, in fact, you talk about all isms, sexism, racism. Last hour we were talking about homophobia, these kinds of things, is all kind of subspecies of rankism. And you talk about identity politics as maybe having diminishing returns. And yet, one can't imagine people going out in the street and protesting for dignity. One can imagine people going out and protesting for, let's say, the indignities that come from sexism, racism, homophobia, and so forth. Is this utopian? I mean, in terms of practical politics, everyday politics, to talk about dignity, to emphasize dignity in an implementation sense?
It can sound that way until you get specific. You're quite right. I don't expect to see people marching with placards that read equal dignity. I do, however, expect to see people with placards that say no more rankism. A movement needs two things. It needs to know what it's for, and it also needs to know what it's against. If you look at the women's movement, when Betty Friedan gave birth to the second wave of the women's movement, not all that much happened for several years, except a lot of consciousness raising. Her book lacked the word sexism. She had the first chapter in her book was called The Problem Without a Name, but she didn't give it one. 5 years later, another feminist coined the word sexism, and from that moment on, women knew what they were against, and they could march against it. I can see people in companies and organizations, in hospitals and in universities. In fact, they're already coming forward and asking me to do workshops on how can we prune rankism out of our organization. Because rankism isn't just being nice to other people. Of course, it includes that. But it means going to the trouble of understanding their contribution to the whole organization. It means assuring them that they won't be banished. It means telling them they have a place. Now, their place in the organization may change, but regardless of what rank they hold, they will be held with respect.
It could work both ways, too, of course. I mean, there are those, for example, lower down in the rank hierarchy who have a kind of animus toward anybody who is of higher rank.
That's right, and that's because rankism is still sanctioned in our society. I mean, that could have been said that blacks might have a background animus towards whites in a time when America was completely racist and segregationist. But as we get rid of those old prejudices, old patterns of discrimination, blacks are less and less apt to carry a constant animus towards whites. They may be on guard for 40 years, but I see a time down the road where there won't be that background animus.
This is a very hopeful philosophy. I mean, but it's tied in with, as you see it, democracy and where democracy is moving. Yeah?
Yes, it's very much tied in democracy. Democracy was perhaps our second human invention for curtailing rankism. The first was the marketplace. The marketplace is a brilliant device for forcing rankism out of transactions, because it means we have competition, and the competition will bankrupt any company that indulges too much in rankism, because the employees will be disloyal, and the company will gradually have to give way to companies where they are led by a boss who doesn't tolerate indignity in the company, and who champions dignity of everybody, and who insists that his subordinates do it. That's one of the main discoveries in Jim Collins' book, Good to Great, that great executives actually don't indulge in rankism, nor do they permit their subordinates to indulge in it.
In fact, they work more collectively.
They work more collectively, cooperatively. I mean, cooperation turns out to trump tyranny. And if it didn't, none of this would be true. But over and over again, where we can manage to figure out how to cooperate and where we deny people who do hold power the right to abuse it, we create organizations that win in the marketplace.
Because how do you quantify what abuse of power is? Sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, grand abuses of power are easy to distinguish and easy
right.
to see, but there are some of these sort of nuances to abuse.
They're nuanced. It can be as small as a raised eyebrow that signifies a sneer. Or a tone of voice. Those are the smallest.
Did you see The Devil of Prada, Wears Prada?
Yes, I did, and it was
Meryl Streep did that brilliantly. Didn't
she did it absolutely brilliantly, and it was. However, it didn't bother us quite as much as it would if her victim hadn't been one of the most beautiful young women in the world, and you knew she was going to survive all this. But when
poor Anne Hathaway had to put on weight to look at least initially not as beautiful and adorable
that's true.
As she is.
But when you see rankism visited upon helpless, weak people, as in the aftermath of Katrina, for example, we recoil in horror that the fact that those people were poor, weak, elderly, aged, sick, that those people had none of the protections that would have been afforded people who were powerful and strong. It was a classic example of rankism writ large for all to see, and it was appalling.
We're talking to Robert Fuller. His newest book is called All Rise, Somebody's, Nobody's, and the Politics of Dignity. Politics of Dignity, I mean, you make a case here that rankism is rife in our social and civic institutions and certainly rife with the kind of enmity that exists and is so pervasive politically, the way campaigns are conducted, for example. Here's where we come up against kind of a boulder or a wall of realism in some ways in my mind. That is, negative campaigning works. So to bring dignity into campaigning, again, seems like one of those dream-catching notions on the face of it.
Negative campaigning still works. It's not going to work much longer, if I'm right. People are beginning to see through it. I've been in 25 states in the last couple of years, including Wyoming, Idaho, Tennessee, some so-called red states. These people are as fed up with the incivility of campaigns as anybody. And yes, it still works, meaning there's enough people still influenced by it so that they go with it, just as racism used to work as an open campaign device.
Willie Horton.
Yeah, it was necessary. But now we're beginning to see through that kind of trick uses of racism or homophobia. We're just at a tipping point where I think people are going to recoil against it and where it's going to backfire. We haven't quite had that backfire incident yet, but you get to that in every movement. We got to it with Bull Connor in the civil rights movement. We were approaching it with John Bolton in the dignity movement. The fact that he had abused his subordinates was a real problem for him when it came to winning approval as the president's nominee for United Nations ambassador. He had to appoint him when the Congress wasn't in session, and John Bolton almost became a poster boy for rankism.
How do we protect against rankism, though, and how is dignity protected? I mean, there are devices that you have in mind specifically?
Well, it's very difficult to protect against rankism because, by definition, the person perpetrating it does have higher rank with more power than you do. So to be an uppity nobody is as dangerous as it used to be an uppity slave. So you have to proceed with caution. You have to...
Well, not necessarily quite as dangerous.
No, not as dangerous.
You don't get flogged.
There the penalty was actually being lynched. Here it's losing your job. But it's functionally similar in that until you have the power of numbers, you're very vulnerable. You have to organize and organize very carefully. I mean, I remember being...
Like unions?
Like unions. Unions are an example of an anti-rankist invention. Another one was what the barons did at Runnymede 800 years ago when they figured out we can't beat King John one at a time, but if we organize ourselves and threaten him collectively, we can force him to circumscribe his powers. And he did sign the Magna Carta, and that was one of the birthplaces of democracy. I tried it 800 years later with my friends at a summer camp where there was a bully named Bert who was picking on each one of us and dispatching us into the ground, and because he'd gone through puberty and none of the rest of us had, and I thought that if we got all 10 of us together, we might be able to handle him and subdue him. And so we all agreed we would jump on him next time he picked on one of us. But what happened was only two of us jumped on Bert, and he could still take down two of us. It requires training and practice before you confront someone who has greater power, who is abusing it. And I learned that by winding up in the dirt under Bert's heel because I hadn't organized my friends well enough and trained them well enough.
Or because they were craven.
Yeah, they hung back a half a second to see how things would turn out.
So you're talking about dignitarian models, really, for mm-hmm. education, for health care, for politics, as I mentioned, also for religion.
I'm talking about spreading the idea of equal dignity through all our social institutions. I'm talking about transcending the identity politics that we have been engaged in for 40 or 50 years to our great advantage, I believe. But now I think we're poised to transcend it and begin to focus less on all these distinctions and differentiations and simply demand that any human being has to be respected with dignity, period. And then to translate that principle into each of our institutions, from the family, workplace, health care, the military and guardian professions, and even into religion.
I know you see this whole idea of rankism as a cancer, and as I said before, the other thing, sexism, racism, in many ways subspecies. Is there a danger by emphasizing dignity and by looking at the whole cancer, to use your metaphor, that you miss or dilute some of the other...
Yes, I think there is, and I think it would have been premature to introduce this idea much sooner than it was introduced. We were very effective at organizing against the indignities that were inflicted on classes, starting with Jews, actually. When I was a child, anti-Semitism was still fashionable. It was still impossible to get into Yale, Princeton, and Harvard, except a small number of Jews would be accepted there. There was a quota against more than about 5%. And then we moved, the national focus shifted after World War II to racism and moved on to sexism and homophobia and ageism and classism. I think all those campaigns were necessary and really saved America. Without them, we would be a disgrace, and no one would have looked to us in the last 50 years for leadership. But now's the time to raise the level to a higher place where we simply say we'll can keep fighting for the dignity of every one of those groups that has been subjected to particular forms of abuse and discrimination, each of which has its own name. But we'll also take in, under the umbrella, into the tent, every American and ask for equal dignity for all of them. So that, for example, when a black humiliates a black and can't say it's racism, we'll have a word for it. I go teach
liberty, fraternity, equality, dignity is what
yeah,
you're saying.
Yeah, add dignity and the other three begin to work much better.
But this is not egalitarian necessarily.
It's not egalitarian except in one sense. We're equal in dignity. It's equal. It's egalitarian in that sense. Egalitarianism generally has gotten a very bad name, and deservedly so, because it was confused about what it was people were equal in. We are not equal in talents and abilities, and therefore there's no reason we should be of equal rank. On the other hand, we should have to re-earn our rank periodically so that people who are coming up in the system get a chance to compete for rank.
Well, there you get into some real quandaries. Does offering dignity, let's say, to people who have been historically ranked lower and oppressed and exploited and all of that necessitate something like affirmative action? In other words, something compensatory or reparations?
I think it does. I think it often does, and I think defining certain crimes as hate crimes is an example of that. It's a compensatory thing that probably won't last more than a score or two score years. But it draws attention to a special egregious form of rankism, and as such, it's very useful.
I'm talking to Robert Fuller. His book is All Rise, Somebody's Nobody's in the Politics of Dignity. In a few moments, we'll get you involved in this discussion. I just wanted to ask you, maybe if you would, you said it might be difficult, but define dignity for us as you see it.
I think dignity is one of those multifaceted things that has several different shades of meaning. But the primary one is we want to know that there's a place for us. It doesn't have to be the top place. It can be some place, but there is a place for us, to quote the song, Leonard Bernstein's song in West Side Story. And when we know there's a place for us and we have dignity security, we don't mind so much not having job security, just so long as for sure we have dignity security. We're willing to shift jobs or ranks, but up till now we haven't been, because the only way to ensure our dignity was to get a high enough position where no one dared threaten it. Rankism is still very prevalent. We're still largely unconscious of it. But we're coming into an awareness of it, just as we came into an awareness of sexism. And as we do, everything changes. You start seeing people differently. Little behaviors shift. Terms get redefined. And just as the relationships of men and women were transformed in the 70s, I think the relationships, all of our relationships, are going to be transformed in the 21st century and are going to be capped with an actual national politics of dignity, which is something we haven't spoken about much yet.
But you base this hope on what specifically? Just intuitiveness?
It's partly intuitive. It's partly because I know that what people hate is indignity. And once they have a word with which to resist it, they're going to begin to resist it. I know of examples where employees have gone in and complained about rankist treatment, and their boss usually says, "What's that?" And then they explain it, and very often the boss will take a second look.
The boss can say you don't like it, heave ho, though. He's still got the power. She still has the power.
He may. But some of them are beginning to look at it, especially when they're confronted in anonymous reviews in the workplace with a 360-degree perspective.
And national politics would be overcoming this kind of divide and chasm that exists between liberals and conservatives, red states and blue states.
It would do that. It would restore civility to politics, but it would do so by drawing what is right and correct in the conservative position and marrying it to what is right and necessary in the progressive position in a new synthesis, a new model, a dignitarian politics that I think can elect a president within 6 years.
On the dignitarian ticket?
I don't know. I doubt it'll have that name. But I think what it will do is reach into the vast, sensible middle of the American political spectrum, shuck off the 15% at the far left and far right, and go to that middle where all people want dignity. And believe it or not, they're willing to give it to others in order to get it themselves.
Well, let's go to our vast audience here and get some response from you about the whole idea of dignity in politics and society and institutions, at work, really in your own personal lives. That's what we're focusing on with Bob Fuller. His new book is All Rise. I mean, a dignitarian movement, which he is advocating. It all has to do with rankism and the idea of the division in our society between somebodies and nobodies. Let me give you a phone number to reach us at. We'd like to hear your thoughts about this, or any questions or comments are welcome. Toll free, 866-733-6786. Again, our toll free number, 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Robert Fuller, who lives in Berkeley now and who is the author of All Rise, Somebody's, Nobody's, and the Politics of Dignity. And that's what we're talking about, and we're going to go right to your phone calls without tarrying here, and we begin, Andre, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a very specific question, and so we are raised with specific standards and views depending on where we came from and such, and as I'm listening to this conversation, I'm wondering, regardless of what our political or position is or our position in the workforce, what are the daily tools, conscious efforts or exercises that we can use to sort of keep tabs on or try to become
more mindful of dignity?
More mindful of and a dignitary of other people, regardless of, you know, whatever their ranks are. You know, sometimes there's so many things to think about and you kind of forget how to behave and not to raise the eyebrow and this sort of thing. What are these tools? Are there any tools? How can we keep tabs on what we're doing? And I can take my answer off there.
All right. We thank you for the call.
Well, the caller points out that rankism begets rankism. When we are subjected to indignity, the first thing we want to do is slap back. And often we can't because the person who subjected us to indignity has more power. So we slap down instead, or we end up kicking the dog.
Or slap ourselves.
Yeah, or slap ourselves. Very often we internalize this. And by the way, doing that is extremely bad for your health. They've discovered that in the workplaces that are chronically filled with rankism, it's the equivalent of the employee smoking 3.5 packs of cigarettes a day. It's that.
Which study was this?
It's some study that is in my book, and I can't remember, Michael. I can't cite it, but it's quoted in there. And it may be Adler's study in UC San Francisco. Margot Adler is a student of this phenomenon. Now, the caller asks, what can we do? The first thing to do is to, after biting your tongue, is to see if you can avoid passing that rankism down the totem pole. When you do pass it down, and I certainly do, we all do, rankism is second nature to us, just like racism was when I was a child and sexism when I was a teenager, homophobia even later. Those things were in the air. It was almost mandatory to participate in that consensus, which we now as a society have rejected. But while that consensus was in place, if you didn't participate in it, it looked like there was something wrong with you. And the same is true of rankism today. But I catch myself being curt or sneering at something or indulging in some indignity, and then I notice that it bothers me later, that I worry the person will hate me. And you live with that until the time that you begin to catch it before you emit the behavior. And then you're on the road to changing your own way of treating people. But it's just as hard as transforming the behavior, say, that males had towards females or whites had towards black. For a generation or two, you need the structures of political correctness to help you suppress behaviors that you're getting rid of. The good, and that's annoying. We all hate political correctness. But the good side of it is your kids don't pick it up because they don't see it as much. I mean, my grandparents used the N-word. My parents didn't. My brothers and I, therefore, didn't pick it up and didn't have to unlearn it. My kids date interracially, and my grandchildren are interracial. And you see that over five generations, a society can make real change in this regard, but not overnight.
Mindfulness is also, I think, a key word here. And one of our listeners brings up the notion that maybe the real concept ought to be seen in terms of respect. This is Kate who says, just an opinion. Dignity cannot be taken away from anyone who behaves honorably or innocently. People in power who abuse others lose their own dignity but can't take the dignity of their victims. It is perfectly possible to maintain your dignity even in a ditch. It's the one who throws you into the ditch who is without dignity. I'd vote for another word, respect. That puts the onus for the emotion in the right place. The powerful owe their respect to their fellow humans.
It's a very useful additional word in this business. On the other hand, it doesn't quite capture what a nobody wants. A nobody is tired of being nobody, being taken for a nobody. Even if they feel their own dignity, they are being taken for a nobody by others. And yes, what they want is respect from other people, but they also want to feel that they won't be banished, that they have a place, and it's a place of dignity, and that their dignity is equal to that of anyone else in the society.
And, you know, sometimes the key to this is, I'm thinking about lessons from my mother, is just being kind, which was mm-hmm. very important to her. And the idea that you can be kind and compassionate and respectful to people until they give you cause to act otherwise.
Kindness is a big part of it, but it doesn't go far enough in the societal setting, because we can be kind to people but pay them a wage they can't live on, pay them a wage on which they can really not experience a dignified membership in our society. We can be kind to people, but not extend health care to them.
You're talking about human rights, really, in a sense, aren't
you? It moves on over into enlarging our sense of human rights so that we feel a right to dignity, and that translates into things like raising the minimum wage until it's a living wage. Not paying the CEO 10,000 times as much as the janitor, a factor of 7 or 10 maybe. That's much more common in the world. But in this country, the average factor is 500, and that's the result of rankism practiced over years, in which the board of governors of the corporation and the CEO have really gone into cahoots to raise his salary to inordinate levels.
Or her salary.
Yeah.
Ruth, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
I was thinking along that level on the international front. There are some citizens of some countries are regarded as somebodies, whereas other countries' citizens are regarded as nobodies. Particularly in the two big conflicts going on now, there's a lot of tragedy attached to deaths of Israelis, which is absolutely justified, but the names of the Palestinians that get killed and the houses that get demolished are regarded as some like objects rather than people. And I feel it's tragic on both sides. And similarly in Iraq, the deaths of Iraqis are not even counted by the United States government. And these are, I think that all people are people, and they're very, all people are valuable. But some countries get sort of a free pass no matter how destructive their actions might be. They're regarded as terrorists if they do the same thing.
Thank you for your remarks. Tanya sends an email here that I have to respond to. She says, Michael's comment about Anne Hathaway having to put on weight which disguised her beauty is an example of his own body type prejudice. With 2 hours devoted to tolerance and dignity, he really ought to watch it. Well, thanks for making me mindful of these things, Tanya. I have to confess, though, this comes from, unfortunately, reading things like People magazine. Not to excuse that, but because I don't think I have these prejudices, but there is this description of the making of the movie in things like People about how the young woman had to dress down, become larger and so forth, so she wouldn't look as attractive on the screen. And I think, you know, does that have to do with body prejudice? Of course it does. I think she's right about that. Stephanie writes, I was inspired by Bob Fuller's book, Somebody's Nobodies, and wrote the first known resignation letter based on rankism. It worked. Things changed at my job, and I continued working there as an educator. I was further inspired to write a children's book, I Feel Like Nobody When I Feel Like Somebody When, which is a children's book used in schools to open a dialogue on dignity. I'm trying to call in, but the line is busy. Well, thank you for the email. This is Judith who writes, I've read All Rise, and I see it as an incredibly insightful analysis and explanation for many of the ills that are present in our day-to-day encounters, society in general, and the world at large. Could Dr. Fuller describe some respectful methods one can use when faced with obvious displays of rankism? Are there effective ways to get through to people who are indulging themselves at your expense?
A lot of lessons can be drawn from the earlier movements in which people of less power had to confront people of more power. I'm thinking of civil rights and women's movement. What did the women teach us when they gradually learned how to confront men? First off, they would often go into the boss, who was a sexist boss, let's say, and say to him, "When you act like that, I feel like this." And that is not quite a firing offense. That's a way of putting it that simply is a report of how you're feeling when the boss screams at you, for example, or when the doctor throws his coat on the floor and expects the nurse to pick it up. You can tell people how their behavior makes you feel, usually without annoying them to the point that they fire you. So there are lessons we can take from the earlier movements and how they confronted their oppressors, their exploiters. But the chief lesson is power lies in numbers, organization, and training.
And lawsuits often.
And lawsuits, absolutely. There's not much of a body of law against rankism yet, although there are laws against specific kinds of rankism, like embezzlement, like sexual harassment, like elder abuse, like the child abuse the priests were indulging in. There are laws against specific forms of rankism, but there are no laws against it in general. And I don't actually think that the main progress against rankism will be made in a legal context. I think it'll be made one organization at a time. And I've been both the companies, universities, and hospitals where the top person wanted to explore making their organization more dignitarian, because he or she felt this would increase the fun of working there and increase the productivity of the organization. And so you then engage in a day-long process where people of all ranks get to speak out and people become more sensitive to the ways in which indignity is built into the structure of the organization.
We go to more of your calls. Eugene from San Jose. Good morning.
Hello. I'm very struck with Dr. Fuller's talk. I heard him speak at a local college a couple of years ago. After a career in industry, I was invited to teach as an adjunct faculty member, and as Dr. Fuller knows, this is a very inexpensive form of labor for the university. And after teaching for a few years, I was very surprised at some of the disdain that was shown by the tenured faculty members towards the untenured faculty members and the adjunct faculty members. I was wondering how Dr. Fuller dealt with it in his own university that he was a president of, if it did occur, and what has he seen in other universities since he's published his books. And I'll take the answer offline. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Eugene.
We dealt, when I came to Oberlin in 1970 as president, we did have a class of faculty called adjunct faculty, and as everywhere, they were paid about a third as much as regular tenured faculty, and it struck a lot of us as unfair because we could see no real difference in the quality of the work. Most of these adjunct faculty were actually female because their husbands had gotten the jobs, and that was the little slot they were put into. So we created a new system in which there was equal status for people, where even part-timers got a vote and where they were paid more proportionately. So if they were a third part-time, they got a third of a full salary instead of a tenth of a full salary. The adjunct faculty idea is forces one group of faculty to subsidize the college much more than others in the college are. It's analogous to Barbara Ehrenreich's insight in Nickel and Dimed that the underclass in America is now effectively a benefactor for all the rest of us because their very low salaries subsidize low prices, which the rest of us, and they too, get the benefit of. At some point in dignitarian politics, we're going to have to take a close and hard and agonizing look at the fact that we still segregate off certain groups, give them a different title, and then feel justified in exploiting them.
In some universities, part-timers, for example, don't even get health care, and it's not unusual to find them. I mean, there really is a kind of line of demarcation that separates the tenured from the untenured, that even hierarchically separates, say, full professors from lecturers, adjunct professors, associate right. and assistant professors. It's very much like the military in some respects. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have your PFCs who do the cleanup. These are the people who are teaching off in the introductory courses. And
right, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's rankism, because those people teaching the introductory courses sometimes haven't got the experience, especially if they're teaching assistants and don't have their doctorate yet. It can be justified to a certain extent as part of the learning experience. And it was for me when I was a teaching assistant in physics. I didn't mind. I'd give my left hand to have that opportunity to teach, because I was learning and I was still a very young person. But the main place where this is a problem isn't in the universities, although it is one there. It's in the society as a whole, where we've institutionalized an underclass and where we have all sorts of covert and subtle ways of keeping them in that place. The truth about America now is that the American dream, which has been why the world has loved us as it has for a century, the American dream is becoming a mirage. You can't really escape from the underclass unless you win the lottery. And unless we repeal that fact, unless we reinstate an American dream, unless there's an escalator which anyone can ride in one generation of hard work into the middle class, then America as we've known it will cease to be, and we will cease to be loved by the world. We're in great danger of that now. That is a greater danger to us in terms of terrorist threats than anything else. So,
can you treat those who want you destroyed with dignity? I mean, there are those
you can.
Who really want us to be annihilated.
In fact, you had better treat them with dignity, because if you don't, it creates more sympathizers for them. If someone commits a crime or a murder, they go to prison. But while in prison, they should be treated with dignity, so that if they ever do get out, they're not seething for revenge. And they actually, there's studies now that show that the few prisons in this country that have inmates treated with dignity are prisons that have a much lower recidivism rate. It is in our interest not to be vengeful and continue to punish people when they're already being punished by being put in prison.
I'm talking more about those who would, for example, hit us like we got hit on 9/11. I mean, in dealing with let's say, those who support those kind of groups, for example, or who give them sanctuary, like the Taliban did in Afghanistan.
Doesn't mean we don't go in and take out the Taliban. We can do so with dignity. If they are attacking us, it's perfectly okay to defend ourselves with military means. On the other hand, we can be very careful, and some leaders are very careful, not to insult the dignity of the groups from which these people come.
Let me go to a few more emails before I go to more of your calls. This is from John in Oakland. This is, the first person who comes to my mind when I think of treating others with dignity and without rankism is Fred Rogers. Ironically, I didn't watch Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood as a child, but would find myself watching as an adult from time to time, spellbound at the way all members of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, the postman, the baker, the teacher, were treated with dignity without any hint of rankism. A few minutes of watching his show were a tonic for me. Where are the Fred Rogers in our public life today? Well,
what a beautiful example.
Yeah, he was, wasn't he? He really was. I said when he died, we will not see this like again, but let's hope I was wrong. Here's Kyle, who says, I attend Harvard University and I'm home for the summer. When people find out I go to Harvard, many are pleased and act like attending an Ivy League university, particularly Harvard, is an ideal for all college-bound children to attain, as if the U.S. News college rankings are correct arbiters of academic prestige. Am I the only one who thinks this is disgusting? As much as I love Harvard, it's far from perfect, and it's not the right place for everyone. In my opinion, college rankism directly detracts from the dignity of other institutions that have their own unique experiences to offer. Excellent point. We did a whole show on that. Here's a listener who says, I'm an attorney who is in court 5 days a week in front of many different judges. Your program gave me insight as to why one of our judges, who by some measures might be one of the toughest, is so widely respected. He is the epitome of a dignitarian. On the other hand, rankus perfectly describes another of our judges. What's sad is that the behavior becomes, for many members of the public who sit in his courtroom, a rankus reflection on the justice system. Does your book offer strategies on dealing one-on-one with rankists?
For one thing, you can use the word. Some people know the word. When I was on this show with you, Michael, 6 years ago, if you Googled rankism, you got a half a dozen return hits. If you Google it today, you get over 30,000. The word is spreading, and it by itself constitutes some defense because people will say, well, what's that? It sounds enough like racism and sexism and ageism for them to be curious. And once you explain what it is, they realize that it's no more justified than the other familiarisms, so they'll begin to take a look at themselves. They won't change overnight. Neither will you. Neither can any of us. But we can begin to watch ourselves. It turns out we are our own best watchdogs. To correct someone else in a snappy way for their rankism actually usually backfires.
You can immediately hear somebody saying, well, I'm the boss, and so what I do and how I behave
right.
is immaterial to you. I'm the boss.
That's what parents used to say. Parents used to say in my generation, because I said so. I'm the boss. I'm your father, and it's because I said so.
I'm the decider, as Bush said.
I'm the decider. But look what's happened in child rearing. It's a great example of this incipient dignity movement. The boomer generation, for the first time in history, understood that kids are people too. And they stopped saying, because I said so. They started saying, what do you think? And they listened, and then they decided. And that's a big difference. When you don't repress the other person's point of view and their perspective, but incorporate it into your decision-making, you become a parent or a boss or a doctor who the people you're working with love and admire. And that's all it takes.
Here's Mark, who says, a few years ago, I read the book Dealing with People You Can't Stand, How to Bring Out the Best in People at Their Worst. It was very helpful to me in dealing with difficult people in the workplace. I think it would be useful to add the rankest to the list of the 10 most unwanted list by the book. Dealing with rankism seems to me to be just one of the many things you could or should find in a good workshop book for creating a successful business. Marina, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a comment and then a question which I can take off the air. My comment is that an earlier caller mentioned that dignity can't be taken away, and I just want to add that in my opinion, I think it can be, but it's sort of in direct proportion to how much dignity the person already had experienced and internalized, like given to them through the environment they grew up in. And I get that opinion from, in part, growing up in foster care, where I saw kids in group homes, all of us sort of scrambling for rank and some of the dignity amongst ourselves. And there were cases where I stood up to ensure the dignity of another child, but it wasn't because I was superior. It was because I had experienced a level of dignity that was somewhat higher than some of the other kids had experienced in their early years, at least in my opinion. And my question to Dr. Fuller is, I visited the Netherlands decades ago, and I remember being absolutely shocked. That was in my early 20s, and I saw that what I thought at the time was a treatment of citizens with a certain amount of dignity in terms of health care, education, access to shelter and places to live. If they lost their job, their whole life wasn't disrupted. And it was kind of, to me, based on a fundamental belief that people are, A, affected by their social environment, but also that we all intrinsically want to belong. And I'm just wondering how he feels about it. Are there other countries that he thinks are kind of models for incorporating dignity into their social structure? Thank you.
Yes, I think you've named one, the Netherlands and some of the Scandinavian countries. And interestingly, there are three countries on Earth which put dignity into line one of their constitutions. Germany, which suffered such a colossal indignity after it inflicted equally colossal indignity on the world in World War II. Canada, our northern neighbor, and South Africa, another country that was the scene of unparalleled rankism for generations. So I would like to see dignity added to our Pledge of Allegiance and dignity built into our consciousness along with liberty and justice. I think dignity can be a stepping stone from liberty to justice. We haven't seen much progress in the social justice area for a generation. The last amazing advances were the civil rights era when LBJ and MLK teamed up to prevent America from falling into two countries, one black and one white. We're in great danger of becoming two Americas again. And I think that if...
Some would say we already are.
Some would say we already are. There's Barbara Ehrenreich and others are chronicling the divide that threatens America into becoming two Americas.
Well, that's the economic divide, but there's also, of course, the political divide.
The political divide. So there are those two senses. I think they can both be addressed with a dignitarian politics, which pulls from both the right and the left, which makes uncivil discourse seen for what it is. And I think the first politician to do this can actually win a mandate to govern again. And mandates only come along every 30 or 50 years. They're rare. FDR had one. LBJ had one. When they come, they can represent a real leap forward in social justice. And we need one now. We need to keep from solidifying and congealing into two Americas, or we won't be worthy of world leadership, and neither will we be looked to for it.
So if drafted, will you? No, never mind. but I was just thinking about your role as president of Oberlin. Now, when you were, by your own characterization, a nobody seeking a publisher, and these ideas were stirring and solidifying in your mind and so forth, it made a difference, I would presume, to say to people, well, I was president of Oberlin. I do have a PhD in physics. I mean, that elevates rank. You can elevate your rank just by what you were or what you have accomplished as opposed to what you are.
To some extent, you can. It would get my foot in the door. But the only place that opened the door was Forum in San Francisco.
Go to more of your calls, and let's go to Santa Rosa. Lynn, you're on.
Hello. Thank you, Michael, for having Mr. Fuller again, or Dr. Fuller. I heard it 6 years ago when you had him before, and in the meantime, I've experienced a lot of rankism as just a volunteer, stay-at-home mom, even with a college degree. And I wondered if there is any correlation with, like, sibling placement. You know, I wonder if, as a younger sister, maybe I'm a little bit more less likely to pull rank on people, and some of the people around me seem to be older siblings.
Oh, you've got to read Frank Soloway's book about birth order.
I think I might have checked it out a little bit at a, you know, that might have been influencing my thinking. But is there a correlation, anything going on there, or is it just that ego thing?
Some thoughts, Bob Fuller?
I do. I'm the oldest of three brothers, and I've had to go back and revisit some of the relationships that we had, because as the eldest brother, I was stronger for a while. Not for very long, but maybe for 12 years. And so you have to take a look at that. One woman who stumbled on Somebody's and Nobody's, my first book, and had very serious problems with her siblings, found it helpful in resolving them. And as a result, and because she was in a position to, she bought 20,000 copies of the book and sent them to every country on earth. And that all grew out of the fact that she had had experienced rankism with her siblings.
This is what's known to writers as an angel. Bob Fuller, good to have you back. Thank you so much. Congratulations on all that you've done. The book, again, is All Rise, Somebody's Nobody's and the Politics of Dignity. And I want to give out your website. It's BreakingRanks, one word, .net.
The media used for this episode are at www.unwelcomeguests.net/507. I haven't yet conducted the interview with Lynn Gehry, so if you have any questions, it's not too late to send them to me. My address is unwelcome@altruists.org, or you can use the show's mailing list at www.altruists.org/unwelcome, where we value your feedback on the show or suggestions for how we could do it better. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.